So first of all, I've got a practical announcement. I've been saying for the past couple of weeks that I wasn't sure how it was going to work next week because I'm going to be traveling, and it turns out that it's not going to work. I can't guarantee that I'll have access to internet next Sunday, so we will have to postpone the class by 1 week. So the next class, the last of the six classes, will be on April 1st, Sunday, April 1st. So you will be sent reminders, but you might mentally at least make a note of that the next class will be 2 weeks from now. And correspondingly, although for different reasons, the practice session that was originally going to be set for the weekend of April 7th and 8th is going to be moved back 1 week. And that I did mention to you already. So that will be the weekend of April 14th and 15th. And the reason I say it's the weekend is that the 14th is presumably the day when you spend as much of the day as you can practicing, and then the 15th is when we have our phone call to discuss that. So those are the plans. Any questions about that? Any practical questions? Okay. Okay, good. Then we can start. As I said at the beginning of the orientation for this week, the good thing about going slowly like this, that is really taking our time with the material, is that it lets us get into it, and there are all these different approaches or different images that Rinpoche uses, and by going slowly and taking our—I hesitate to say going slowly—just taking our time, by really letting it, giving ourselves the time to reflect, we can appreciate that, and we can explore different ways, and hopefully then it kind of sinks into our life. The downside of it is that it's easy to forget what was said in an earlier part of the chapter, and it is only one chapter. We've been working with this chapter for 3 or 4 weeks. So actually, for next week, that is 2 weeks from now, I'm going to suggest that you review the whole chapter because our reading for the last class is only two paragraphs, so I don't think it's imposing too much of a burden to say let's review the whole chapter and really try to let it come together. I do think though that going little by little we get a sense of how the structure of it works and how the different pieces fit together, which I have found very helpful and interesting. Before I start, I see that David has asked a question, so let's take a look at that. And it's a substantive question. He asked in the chat section, would I say, that zeroless space is the openness within which fields actively structure mental forms and within which the self process operates? That's my first choice. My second choice is, or would you say zeroless space could be considered the primary field in which other fields operate? Trying to feel this out for myself. The feel of the field, as we like to say, so that's nice. So the question, I think, is it turns on how you're using the word field. I like the word openness, of course. Space is about openness, but it's a particular kind of openness, an openness that allows and accommodates. It's an openness to possibilities. I'm trying to avoid the sense of openness as being just a blankness, like when you say, when the doctor's office says, "Well, I have an opening at 8 o'clock," not that kind of openness. That just means something ready to be filled in. It's an openness, something that's structured in advance and ready to be filled in. This openness is open to new possibilities. And so those possibilities, you could say, manifest as fields. And in that sense, I would definitely say that the openness of the zeroless, let's say, or zeroless space, is something that's primary. So you say a primary field in which other fields operate. I think that that's right. I think fields get set up. Structures get set up. So there's an image that I was thinking of and was going to use a little later today, but it works pretty well here, I think. And that is, if you think of the zero, and Rinpoche uses this example in Knowledge of Time and Space, if you think of zero as the point on an axis, when you draw an axis, you have the what's that called? I don't know what you call that actually, but you draw the x-axis and the y-axis, right? Here, let's see, where's my hand? No, I can't do it with my hand. It's too. But you know what I'm talking about. You draw the x-axis, which is horizontal, and the y-axis, which is vertical, and the place where they meet, the point where they meet, is the zero, right? And so then once you've drawn that axis, you can plot all kinds of information, all kinds of data on it. And you could say that that graph with its x-axis and its y-axis is like a field, right? And depending on how you've defined the x and the y-axes, you can only plot certain kind of information. And that's what fields are like too. Depending on how the field has been set up, there's only certain kinds of experiences, certain kinds of identities, certain kinds of substances, all the things that make up reality. You say, well, there's a reality particular to that field. And zero is the like the starting point. The zero point is the point from which all of that radiates out. The field radiates from the zero, and that's actually really very important for the topic that we're looking at today. But zeroless is like the openness before you've defined the point, before you've drawn your lines. So it is primary, absolutely. And whether you want to call that a primary field, if you define field the way I just defined it, then you probably don't want to use that language. But in another sense, if you want to use that image, or stay with that image of a graph, you'd say, well, the zeroless is like the blank sheet of paper. Once you've got the piece of paper, you can draw your x-axis and your y-axis with the zero point at the middle that makes everything possible. If you didn't have the paper or something to draw on, you could never get started. And in that sense, you could say the blankness of the paper is stands in relationship to the graph as the zeroless stands in relationship to reality. I think that image works. So that's something, it's an interesting question, and I hope it helps move things along. It is very much related to what we're talking about today. Any comment on that, or any question coming out of that? Sure. So the question I want to start with in terms of the discussion is exactly the question that Rinpoche starts with at the beginning of the reading. He says, how does it happen that we do not already inhabit a zeroless space realm? So here we are in the zeroless, or here we are not in the zeroless, here we are inhabiting a field. And he's saying, well, why aren't we in, why don't we already have immediate access to this zeroless? Because you remember at various points in this chapter, Rinpoche has been saying, if you could contact the zeroless, you would be freeing yourself from all kinds of limits, from identities and the kind of core quote that I marked is on page 44. He says, a zeroless world would offer neither blockage nor would offer neither blockage, restrictions, nor borders. There would be no occupancy or possession, and hence no interruption. There would be no point at the center, and that's that zero point that we were just talking about, right? And no point that encompasses the whole, no structure that would support such distinctions as center and periphery. So there would be this tremendous freedom, and you might think of that as the blank sheet of paper. Although the word blank, you know, I think points us in the wrong direction, but you understand it as kind of a symbol for freedom. So the question is, why don't we already inhabit a zeroless space realm? Well, in light of what we've been talking about these first few minutes, this is not quite the direction I was going to go in, but I think it's a point well worth making. There's a kind of a contradiction in terms there, or you know, impossibilities for existence. If you think of the blank sheet of paper, there's no inhabiting it. You know, it's like, okay, once you've drawn the graph, then you can plot points on it. You've got your structure. You've got your x-axis and your y-axis. In the quote that I read from page 44, he talks in terms of a circle or a sphere, a center and periphery. But it's the same thing. A domain has been set up. A reality has been put in place, and we can inhabit that reality. Now, the very nature of the zeroless is that you can't inhabit it, because nothing ever gets set up. So that's one answer to that question. And I think it's an important answer because, well, we'll see. But I want to go ahead and look at it a little bit differently. It's such an important question because, you know, a lot of you have a background in Buddhism, but anybody who's in any, let's call it the tradition of inquiry, the question, that same question arises because, you know, the problem is, why do we have to discover the truth, you know? Why isn't the truth immediately available? Why do we have to discover the way things are, or if you don't like to say it that way, you know, why do we have to go through some process to clear away illusion? That's a very real question in every tradition, in Buddhism, you know, and here it's being raised in a TSK context, and you say, well, okay, maybe you could say I got distracted by the fact that Karin posed a question. I'll look at that in a moment. But what I was starting to say is the possibility is the same in TSK. You say, well, something has been set up. Why does something get set up? Why don't we just stay in the zeroless? Now, stay, inhabit, abide, those were all terms that don't quite fit here, but there is a sense where you'd say, all of this construction, you know, who's doing the constructing? How does the construction take place? Why can't we just go back to a state that's earlier? I may have quoted this last week. I'm not sure. I did quote it last week to somebody, but I don't know if it was here. There's a famous passage after the Buddha is enlightened, and he says, I have seen the builder of the house, and you shall build no more. And it's like that. You say, well, the house is what gets built in the openness, the accommodating possibility of space. What's the dynamic? What's the momentum? Why does it get set up that way? So that's the question. But I see that we have a little discussion going on here in the chat room, so let's take a look at this. You know, David, when I answered David's question, I did it in kind of a theoretical way, but David did say he was trying to feel out whether, you know, space is something more primary than the field. I think Karen's responding partly to that. So Karen says, my experience was to focus on my attitude. When I allow an openness for the next moment, there's a connection to the energy of accommodating. But this allowing is not natural, I have to remind myself. Well, Karen, maybe, I'm not sure, but it sounds as though you're actually referring to the question that I was asking, or that the book asks, which is, why aren't we already inhabiting a zeroless realm? And if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the possibility of the zeroless has to do with an openness, an attitude of openness, and allowing for what, and you say, but you say that's not allowed, that's not natural, you have to remind yourself. And so that's really another way of making the same point or asking the same question. Why isn't it natural? Why are we committed to a structure that makes things solid and real instead of zeroless and open? And, you know, tying it back into attitude, I think, is really important. All of this, I think, these points are all closely related to each other. And Sudaba raises, offers what I think is really another way of asking this. The unconscious need to be something propels me toward this fabrication in an unconscious way? Question mark. That's her question. Is that what's going on? That there's an unconscious need to be, and I suppose you say once you need to be, then you need to be something. And that propels me towards fabrication. Is that what's going on? Yes, I think so. I think that, you know, clearly there's some momentum. So if you use the image of the Buddha as the builder of the house, you'd say, well, who hired the builder, you know, or who had the bright idea of building a house? Was it really necessary to do that? I guess the image of the Garden of Eden comes in the way, but I'm not going to try to deal with that. So, yes, we find ourselves fabricating. I think that that's a really legitimate answer to this question. Why don't we already inhabit a zeroless space realm? Well, because we've fabricated, we've built, we've constructed something that is not zeroless, something that is field-related, that assigns identities and names and all of those things we've been looking at really throughout this program. Still, the question is, why do we do that? So Sudaba is suggesting there's an unconscious need to be something. And again, I think that goes in just the right direction. So the question probably that I want to ask, because it's going in the direction that the book, that this reading takes us, is who has this unconscious need? And then if you just gave a name, if you just said, well, it's Jack that has this unconscious need, you know, or it's Karen or whoever, that would obviously not be the end of the question. It would be the beginning and say, well, what is it about Karen, or what is it about this one who has the need? You know, what's this unconscious need to be that propels us toward construction or fabrication? Sudhi, you say, it propels us in an unconscious way. And it is in an unconscious way, that is to say, we're not aware of it. In principle, we could be aware of it. It's not that there's something about the way, I think I'll just stop there. In principle, we could be aware of it. But it is something we're not aware of, assuming that it's there at all. I mean, because it's not there, you know, we need to look carefully. I mean, because we're not aware of it, I should say, we need to look carefully and see, is this actually what's going on? Okay, so let's take a look at where the reading goes. It's just the next paragraph. Actually, the end of this first paragraph. It says, so there's this zeroless realm, and it's interestingly described as a kind of universal knowingness, right? I said before, a blank sheet of paper, and the problem with that image is blank sounds so dead and dull and nothing going on. But you have to think of the blank sheet of the blankness as being openness, and in that sense, that's actually a very nice image. Or in our culture, probably it works a little better to use the image of a blank canvas, right? It's possible to create, to paint anything on that canvas. And the same for a sheet of paper. It's possible to draw anything on that sheet of paper. Or we have the image of the blank sheet of paper in a typewriter. Of course, nobody uses typewriters anymore, but at least we all remember what they were. So you're sitting there with this blank sheet of paper in your typewriter, and usually when that image is used, it's as a kind of almost an image of despair. It's blank and you have no idea what to put there. You're about to create something out of nothing, out of that blankness. But you could, and you're stuck. You don't know what to put, or it's a challenge, and you're afraid to face it. But it's just as true, and much more true to the spirit of TSK, that that blank sheet of paper in the typewriter represents infinite possibility. Or, as this paragraph says, represents a universal knowingness. There, in that blankness, before something gets created, there is nothing that's unknown. There couldn't be. It's only the moment you start to manufacture something that you automatically exclude everything else. If you're sitting there at the typewriter and you type the letter A, then every other letter has been excluded. But before you type, everything's possible and everything can be known. So that's the zeroless. Why are we not there? He says, how does this take place? Is someone or something responsible? So that's the question. Who's the one? Is it the who's the builder of the house, the fabricator of the fabrication? And he gives a possible answer, right? And that's where we want to go. He says, within ordinary experience, a candidate at once presents itself. At the center of experience stands the self or I. And this is very much related to this image that I was using before about the graph. You've got the zero at the center of the graph where the x-axis and the y-axis meet. And it's on the basis of that zero point that everything else radiates out. I mean, the way we, if you're, again, take your blank piece of paper and draw a graph on it, what you do is you draw the one line vertical and one line horizontal, and then you've got a zero point and you label it as zero, and now you're ready to put all your information on the graph. But in terms of the dynamic or the, let's say, the underlying structure of that graph or of the field of what appears, the zero is primary. The point at the center is more primary. It's like the x-axis and the y-axis radiate out from that zero point. If you want to look at that, if you want to see Rinpoche talking about that, he does a little bit at the beginning of Sacred Dimensions, and in the charts at the back of Sacred Dimensions, he does something about that in an interesting, very creative way. But the point, I think, we can all understand, there's something at the center, and that something, it's being suggested here, the candidate for what that something is the self. And notice that when Rinpoche describes what's going on here, he actually uses mathematical language, not language about graphs, but he does say, the self takes this position at the center immediately, automatically. It formulates the equations that project this position outward. Measuring and judging, it presents the perspective of its perceptions, proclaiming substance and solidity. Well, this is one of these wonderful passages that are so common in time-space and knowledge, where, you know, the imagery just comes so fast, and there's so much going on, and it all, it's in a way he's, you know, he's using the language to show you how everything just gets set up all at once. There's all these different things, you know, measuring and judgment and perspective and perceptions and proclaiming and determination and affirming and limitations and claiming and proclaiming, and all that happens, you know. That's the kind of proliferation, that's the kind of making something out of nothing that the self does. And you might even say that one of the reasons that it comes so thick and fast, that there's so many different activities, is that the only way the self can do this is by working really hard, you know, by moving so quickly that you don't notice that there's this problem, because it's all just being manufactured by the self. The whole point for the self is to create a world into which it can project itself, into which it can appear. And again, the image of the zero point and the graph is interesting in that way. I actually remember once, quite a few years ago, Rinpoche was I don't remember the context, but it was a TSK related discussion. I was talking with him, and there were some other people in the room, and he talked about about points. You know, he's very fond of the word point, because we have the word point, and we talk about pointing out, and about pointless, and it's one of the words he likes to play with. And I remember saying something about Euclid and his geometry, and there was a library next door, and we were able to find Euclid's geometry, which I had never really looked at. And I looked at it, and the very first thing it says in Euclid's geometry is it defines a point, and then it defines a line. Those are the first things in Euclid's geometry. And it says a point is the intersection of two lines. And then it says a line is the distance between two points. And that's where the whole geometry starts. And so it's very interesting and somewhat related to this idea of the self being at the center, that it's a circle. It has no basis, right? In order for there to be a point, there have to be two lines. And in order for there to be a line, there have to be two points. Neither of them exists. And in fact, if you were doing a kind of pure logic, you'd say neither of them can ever come into existence, because each depends on the other. By pure logic, I suppose I mean a kind of linear logic. In fact, they come into being on independence on each other. And that's very much how the self works. So, you know, maybe it strikes you as a little strange or not so interesting to be talking about it in terms of geometry and points and lines, but it really is just a kind of a simplified version of what the self does. It creates a world. It claims and proclaims, and it does it in exactly the same way that the zero establishes the X and the Y axis, which create a field. And at the same time, it's established by them. That's it. That's in a nutshell. That's how the self gets set up, and we live out the consequences of that. So if you look back at the question, how does it happen that we do not already inhabit a zeroless space realm? Well, the answer is that we ourselves, right? The self is at the center, and you know, it's like saying, well, how does it happen that the zero, what's the right way to ask that? How does it happen that if I look at a blank sheet of paper, the graph isn't there? Well, you know, it has to be there in order for the zero to show up. You know, you can't say, oh, well, we'll just erase all of that and now we'll look for it again. No, we've erased it. Zeroless means the self is not there. Zeroless means the zero is not there. But in terms of our experience, it means the self is not there. And once we're selves, the zeroless has disappeared. You know, the possibility of zeroless space has disappeared. And that's why Rinpoche writes, I think we came across this earlier, that space itself has disappeared. Because space is fundamentally this quality of allowing, this dynamic of allowing, that is more fundamental than the space realms, the fields that get set up. And if you ask, you know, why are we not in contact with it? Well, it's because we're committed. We're committed to there being a realm. We're committed to there being a zero and points that radiate out from it, a self and structures and identities that radiate out from it. So the self is very much at the center of everything. That's the way we are. And that's what Rinpoche says in the next paragraph, this dynamic of dimensionality. This is the very bottom of page 7. Notice he calls it an imagined dynamic of dimensionality, which is exactly right, exactly what we've been talking about. It's a fabrication. But it's not imaginary in the sense of there's something real and there's something imaginary. It's that the real is imagined. Doesn't make it less real, but it's imagined as being real. Doesn't make it less real, but it doesn't make it, it means that it's not as real as we think it is. Which is pretty much, you know, at the heart of the TSK vision, our ordinary vision of reality is defines reality in a certain way. The TSK vision of reality says that reality is imagined or imaginary, but not in the sense that we would think of if we were going from the ordinary perspective. So Sudha has a question here about this. I am a social animal. Everything I do with others involves this fabrication of selves existing at the center. It's so challenging to remember it's all made up. Yeah, that raises a whole lot of interesting questions because you know, if you're busy thinking about the self at the center, or if you want to explore that, we have been exploring it, and hopefully you're finding that fruitful. But then this question comes up, well, what about other people? And it's challenging in a couple of different ways. One is it's challenging because, you know, for most of us, our relationship with other people is really deeply important. And you could ask, well, do we have to challenge that too? And you know, the answer in a sense is yes. But it's important always to remember that the kind of challenging that we're doing is not a challenging that diminishes. You know, it's not that seeing reality as not real in the ordinary sense doesn't make it, it's hard to say in quite the right way, but I'll try. It doesn't make it less real. It just makes it differently real. And in fact, the differently real is the opposite of less. I don't want to say more real because that seems to throw us back into our ordinary understanding. But it means that reality is much more vast, much more great, a word that Rinpoche has used, than we ordinarily think it is. And the same thing is true for our relationships with people. If we say the world that we hold in common with others, you know, the fabrications that we share, which are our world, and which include the presence of others, all of that is differently real. And you could say more real, but what does more real mean in connection with others? Well, you know, it means that the possibility of engaging others in a more, well, I'll just say a heartfelt way. That's not so much a TSK term, but it's
open.
Okay. Excuse me?
Open.
In a more open way. Well, that's good. That's true. And we talk about it in our hearts, of course. Yeah, the possibility of engaging others is transformed by this differently real way. And so that particular challenge, how do we engage others? I mean, the part that I'm focusing on right at this moment is you don't need to think of it as saying, oh, it's all a fabrication, and all these people I think I care about, they're fabrications too. No. It's not like that. It's not like that. So that's one challenge. And I think that, TSK really leads in the direction, as Rinpoche has written in various places, of great love, not a kind of dismissal of the importance or presence even of others. That's one challenge. Now the other challenge, the challenge of remembering it's all made up. Yeah. It seems that way. I mean, it seems like that's what we have to do. We have to remind ourselves, and that's exactly what Karin said also, right? This accommodating or allowing is not natural. We have to remind ourselves. And that's true because, we don't inhabit a zeroless realm. We inhabit a realm with the self at the center, and it's not within the framework of that inhabiting, it's not natural to go toward the zeroless, to go toward the open and the accommodating. At the same time, and I'm sure you've all had this experience in different ways and different degrees. When you contact this openness, it is natural. When you're in contact with it, it's natural. And it doesn't require a kind of special effort. It's natural in the very specific way that it's effortless. But it's true that we sometimes we're in touch with that, and lots of times, most of the time, we're not. So then we ask ourselves, well, how could we change that? We've had some good questions and some good, I hope they've triggered some good thoughts and discussion. So we haven't gotten as far as I had kind of expected. But let me just take a look at it for a moment, and take a look at where I was going to go and see what we want to do. We're going to have 2 weeks now where we don't meet, so this would be worth looking at, and it goes very much in this direction. I'll point out that Michael has a comment in the chat. He says, "Reopenship." I like that. Reopenship, allowingship, relationship. Well, that's very nice. TSK, as encourages us to be playful, and it certainly encourages us to be playful with language. And so I like what you've done here, Michael. Reopenship, allowingship, and relationship. Different from, we tend, or the TSK books sometimes talk in terms of ness, like allowing ness or knowing ness. But the ship is quite nice, and I wonder how it'd be interesting to think about other words that have ship in them. The one that comes to mind is worship, but I don't know. I don't know. Somebody, go to a dictionary and see what we have for ship. What does that term mean? That's an interesting thought. Okay, the kind of immediate lesson to take away from this analysis, I think it's a beautiful analysis. But if you ask, well, how do we put it into practice, or where do we go? Or if you say, what is the process which will let us reopen and allow and enter into relationship that will help us to deconstruct this constructing that takes place by the self at the center, and help us return to the zeroless. The place to look there is the relationship between subject and object. And that's brought out at the top of page 48. where Rinpoche says the self engages in a process of mutual referring, subject reaches out to object, and object confirms the operation of the subject. Images or shadows projected from the mind as solid are projected to the mind as the inhabited physical space of the existence realm. We don't have time to go any further with the rest of this reading, but I think that connection, that relationship of subject and object, and you could expand that into the area we touched on a little bit today, the relationship not only between subject and object, but between self and other beings, other people, other sentient beings. Although that, you know, that introduces a whole different dimension, but that relationship is really important to explore. And where we're going to go with that, you know, in reading and preparing for this class, I realized that where we're going to go at the end of the next class is on to the next chapter, right? In the next program, we're going to go ahead and read chapters 7 and 8, I think it is. The closing part of the space section of Dynamics. And it's very interesting that what those chapters do is they take us into what you might think of as the subjective realm. And I think that what's happening here is that we're kind of preparing the way for that. You know, we've been looking at space as fundamentally as inhabited physical space, and as dimensionalized space, right, and as a field of existent objects. And they aren't necessarily all physical objects, but still that basic structure which we assign based on the our notion of the physical world, space and objects in space, even if we apply it to the mental realm. Well, by pointing to the connection between subject and object, I think Rinpoche is preparing the path for what will happen in the next chapter, which is that we'll go much more into the mental. You know, you could say the subjective side, that's not quite right. You could say the interior, that's also not quite right. But all of those words, the place it actually is going to show up is in the discussion of thought. The chapter after this one is in fact called Thought Forms. Thought Forms in Space.
Experience.
Excuse me?
Experience.
Yeah, experience is okay. It's another one of these words that you know, I know Rinpoche has said specifically he doesn't think it works that well because experience suggests that there's a self that has the experience. But that's not to say, you know, any word like that, there is no word, you know, no word is ever going to capture what we're after, or no set of words, or no bunch of books. You know, Rinpoche writes, he says, these TSK books, they can't really express it, you know, he keeps writing and writing and writing, but it's not as though now he's got it all nailed down, you know. So words are okay, it's just that when you use them, you have to be sensitive to what it is that they are suggesting. So experiences belonging to a self is something that's suggested by that word. But if you're aware of that, then, you know, that may be a good word to use. We have to find some words. We have to have... Yes.
What is the experience of a subject knowing an object?
Well, that's...
That has experience.
Well, that's getting closer, I think. And so that actually is a good reminder that we do have a word that Rinpoche made up that is related to this, and it's ekgnosis, you know. It's a knowing inward-outward, and that's very similar to what you just said. It's the experience of, I don't remember exactly how you said it, the experience of the subject knowing...
Knowing
the subject knowing, right? Or it's the experience of knowing the subject knowing the object. That takes us in the direction of this inward-outward knowing. And one of the reasons that ekgnosis is a as a made-up word, as a helpful word, is because it doesn't have that connotation of, when you say experience, it sounds like there's someone who experiences or someone who knows. And ekgnosis suggests that it's a knowing inward-outward, and we've explored this in the last few weeks. It's a knowing that's available everywhere, the universal knowingness that Rinpoche refers to that we talked about at the beginning of the session today. Okay, well, I think we need to stop there. Do continue to work with the exercises we've been doing, the abiding, what was it called, abiding in thought. So that's leading us in the right direction. And I also suggested exercise 11, I believe it is, on pages 289 and 90, which has to do with the stories that the self tells. So if you think of the graph on the piece of paper with the zero at the center and the x and the y axis, that's a story, but it's a really impoverished story, you know. The only things that can inhabit that story are numbers or data points of some kind. But that same structure, you could say, is kind of the skeleton, the backbone of every story we tell. And so looking at how we tell stories is a good way to investigate this structure of the zero point and the reality that radiates out from it. And it will also prepare nicely for the whole issue of that we'll take up in the next course. So next meeting is in 2 weeks, and the reading for the is just the last two paragraphs of the chapter. So go back and review the whole chapter, and we will do that in our phone call also. And if it turns out we have to shift the time a little bit, I'll let you know. But I'm going to be in Germany, and I don't know what's going on there. You know, what'll be, but I'm sure I'll be able to set up an internet connection. But you'll receive the usual confirmation of when the time is. But it'll be April 1st. Okay, thank you very much. Talk to you then.